Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who?
His name is Rob.
His name is Rob.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars episode number 28. We are the audio fanzine for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. And I'm your host, Rob Irwin. How are you all? It feels like we've been gone forever. It's only been a couple of weeks, but I think because we did a series of three episodes in a row weekly before going away for a couple of weeks just recently, that it's sort of exacerbated that break to feel like much, much longer than it really was. It feels like I haven't sat in front of this microphone for the longest time. But here we are, episode 28, and what an episode it is. But before we get to that, I do want to mention something. In the previous episode, I spoke about J.R. Southall, who's a writer for Starburst magazine. He's captain of the Blue Box podcast. And I mentioned his new book label, where he'll be reprinting the classic You and Who books, which are, in my opinion, the most important fan-made Doctor Who books ever produced. And I really say that with no exaggeration, and not just because I've got essays in them all. I really do think they're important books. But I'm not here to talk about those. I'm here to talk about the next You and Who book, which is currently being put together, and how you might be able to help contribute to it. If you head over to youandwho.weebly.com, Weebly is W-E-E-B-L-Y, that's the website where all the You and Who material has been put together in the past, and there's now a page for You and Who Else. Now, what is You and Who Else? Well, think of UK telefantasy, which can be a very, very long bow to draw. It covers an awfully huge range of material. And what JR is looking for is similar to the You and Who books, essays of, say, 1,000 to 2,000 words each. They can be a little shorter, they can be a little longer, but generally between about 1,000 and 2,000 words on a particular program this time. In the past, it was particular Doctor Who episodes. Basically, why should someone get into that show? It's almost your recommendation to them. And if you look down the list of possible essays and essays that have already been claimed by people, there is a huge spread of stuff. I mean, at the top here in the A section, I see A Very Peculiar Practice. That's an awesome show. I wouldn't think of it as telefantasy, actually. I mean, it has some fantastical elements, but generally that was a very interesting black comedy starring the Fifth Doctor, Peter Davison, of course, about life in a university as a doctor in the GP clinic in a university, through to things like Blake 7, very much a science fiction, you know, a very hardcore sort of science fiction program from the UK, just awesome, down to Catweasel or Children of the Stones. Do you remember any of these? Danger Man, Doomwatch, Ghostwatch, Hogfather, classic Terry Pratchett there. How about Monty Python's Flying Circus or Quatermass or Robin of Sherwood or Sky or Stingray, The Survivors, The Changes, Day of the Triffids, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, anyone? The Goodies? And of course things like The Prisoner and The Tomorrow People, UFO and Wurzel Gummidge. It's going to be, I think, probably the most interesting You and Who book, from the point of view that in the past, the You and Who books have been of episodes that, as fans, we've typically seen. Whereas this will be full, I guarantee, of TV shows that a lot of people won't have seen at all. I'll be reading this book when it comes out to learn about shows that I might have heard of, or maybe that I've never heard of. But one thing's for sure, I've never seen them. And I'm going to be able to get into the heads of some people to learn why they like these shows and how they affected those people, and why they've perhaps stuck with them for the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years, to the extent that they want to write an essay about them in a book. Now, when you go to youandwho.weebly.com, you can reserve a TV show and contribute to the book. You have to reserve it up front. You send an email to JR saying, I'd like to do you know, demons or escape into night or going postal or something. And then he'll write back if you've been successful. And, you know, success is just based on whether someone has already claimed it or not. In the case of some of the bigger shows, like Doctor Who, for example, JR will take up to 3. And I already see that for the 63 to 89 run of Doctor Who, he already has 3. He has Miles Northcott from the UK, he has Kate Fathers from the US, and he has Dallas Jones from Australia. Dallas Jones used to run the Australian Doctor Who fan club back in the day. So there's some real heavy hitters contributing to this book. There's some first-time writers. It's your chance to sit down and talk about a program, a UK program that meant a lot to you in the past. And I really, really, really implore you to do it. You'll have about 3 months to write your essay, so there's plenty of time to knock out just 1,000 to 2,000 words. That is a hugely long time to do that. And then JR will edit it, of course, and it'll go into print, and it should be out in time for Christmas. So if you've ever had a hankering to be a published author, yes, in a real book with a real ISBN number on the back and a barcode and all that sort of good stuff, and you love UK telefantasy, which again is a very broad spectrum in terms of what this book is letting people write about, I can't encourage you enough to get involved in this. I really can't. And when the book comes out and people are buying it and, you know, showing it on Twitter and Facebook and so on, if you're not involved and you want it to be, I think you'll really regret it. So why not get involved now? Now is your big chance to get in there, grab a show you like, and get involved. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say about that. Moving into this episode, I am so, so excited for a number of reasons. Of course, we've got great Star Wars and Doctor Who content in general, but specifically, we've got our Rebels Roundup, where Alan and John look back on Series 1 of Star Wars Rebels. We've got A.M. Tamburo and Andrew Chalmers from A.M. Audio Media talking to us from Comic-Con in Toronto. I'm really pleased to hear from those guys and hear what's going on in Canada and have them talking to people on the show floor. It's really great stuff. We've got Andy chatting with Al No, formerly of the Diddly Dum podcast, about Season 18 of Doctor Who. And why are they talking about Season 18 of Doctor Who? Well, straight after that, Andy talks to Andrew Smith. Who's Andrew Smith? Oh, he's only the guy who wrote Full Circle, you know, back in the Tom Baker era of Doctor Who. Yes, we have our first Doctor Who writer from the classic era being interviewed on Who Wars. It's just huge. So I hope you can enjoy it. I hope you can just sit back and relax and listen to the Star Wars stuff and the Doctor Who stuff. And I'll join you again at the end of the episode with another of my little editorial pieces, this time on the topic of bands and how bands relate to podcasts. But don't worry about that for now. Just sit back and enjoy what we've got for you here in episode 28. I'll see you later.
On the northern shore of Lake Ontario, near the U.S. border, lies Canada's largest city. Toronto is the capital of the province of Ontario and is a major economic and cultural center for the country.
Hello, this is M.A. Tamburo for the Who Wars podcast.
And this is Andrew Chalmers, also for the Who Wars podcast.
And we're here at Toronto Comic Con 2015, where we're going to be talking to some exhibitors, vendors, and guests.
Yes, we're going to be talking to some wonderful people, some wonderful Star Wars fans at Comic Con in Toronto.
2015. Here we go.
Brilliant, let's go.
So I'm here at Toronto Comic Con with the lead writer on Trouton Is My Doctor, Dan Collins. Hi, nice to see you, Dan.
How's it going?
So we're here at the con today, and do you have what's been your most exciting thing that you've seen today at the convention? And you don't have to flatter me by saying Dark Journey. You don't have to, but I mean, if you want to, I'm not going to stop you.
Okay, then definitely Dark Journey, and you know, Andrew popping out from somewhere and being smaller than I expected.
He is smaller than expected. Yeah,
definitely. That was the highlight.
Have you seen anything Star Wars related at the con?
Lots and lots of Star Wars stuff, even across from us right over there. I see some Star Wars stuff, but, you know, yep, lots of stuff from any franchise you could ever imagine.
Yeah, and have you seen the 501 Legion downstairs? All the stormtroopers all dressed up and ready to go?
I did see them, and I also saw some booth where you could shoot a stormtrooper with a foam rubber gun, which looked like fun. Here's a shameless promotion for you, promoting season 2 of Doctor Who Dark Journey.
What's Doctor Who Dark Journey all about, Dan?
I don't know. I've never heard of it.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for talking to us today, Dan.
Thanks.
And if anyone wants to find out more great Doctor Who news, they can always check out the website. What's it called again?
It's TroutonIsMyDoctor.com.
I'm here with Andrew Chalmers, star of Doctor Who Dark Journey. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Andrew, what is this we're witnessing here? What is this carnage that you see before you here at Comic-Con?
Well, I was just actually interrupted mid-laugh because I was looking at a stormtrooper getting pelted with foam darts by very eager children, which is quite hilarious. So we've got like a shooting gallery. People can shoot a stormtrooper. They can pose with an Imperial Knight or an Imperial Guard.
Yeah.
And it's a great time. Everyone's having a great time. As you can hear in the
background. D2, he is here. Everybody's here.
R2's here. The Riddler at the moment is next to the Imperial Guard, which is a wicked crossover.
Would George Lucas allow that?
I think he,
no one's asking him anymore.
Now it's Mickey Mouse.
So Let's go find out what this is all about.
Let's go. I'm with you.
Oh,
Raymond!
Whoa!
He gave him a nose.
High five. High five the Stormtrooper. All right.
Are you going to go have your picture taken with him?
We're here at Comic-Con for the Who Wars podcast, and I'm speaking with, what's your name, ma'am?
My name is Jennifer Brace.
Jennifer, nice to meet you. And what is it? Can you tell us what, we've got a Stormtrooper here. He's getting shot with all kinds of fun darts. What's going on? What's this all about?
We're raising money for the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and every year we come down and we donate our time and we get to dress up in all these fun things, and we just get blasted with Nerf darts to raise money for kids.
That's wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about the Make-A-Wish Foundation?
Well, I know that they are raising money for kids that have life-threatening injuries, and they are trying to grant them a wish to help them deal with what they're going through and to make their day better.
That's
and
wonderful,
to
yeah.
give them something to hope for.
That's beautiful. And you guys are all volunteers?
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about, are you part of the 501 Legion? Yes.
I'm not an official member. My husband is a member. He is a stormtrooper, and my children are in the Galactic Academy, and they are Jedis.
Whoa.
So we just come and volunteer our time and get to have the benefit of having fun with these guys.
That is great. So what else, what other events does the 501 Legion do?
We do.
The Marleys last weekend.
They go to St. Kitts Hospital to just go around and help kids' days. They go to toy museums. They did one in November, and we got to go to a toy museum in Rochester. We go to pretty much every con. We go to pretty much every con.
Wow, that's exciting. What other? So you're dressed up as a Jedi. What are some of the other fun get-ups that everyone else dresses up in?
Pretty much any costume there is that people can make. There's Royal Guard, Emperor, Stormtrooper, Darth Vader. Even that, the snow monster thingy from the Hoth movie. I can't even think of the name.
So pretty much everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, are you excited for the next Star Wars movie?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah? So what do you think we're going to see in that movie?
Because of the new Stormtrooper helmets, I'm pretty sure a lot of things are going to change.
Uh-huh.
And especially because it's not George Lucas anymore. It's Disney. It's Leia is officially a Disney princess. So it's going to be definitely a pretty good movie.
And neat special effects.
Yeah, definitely neat special effects.
Ah, wonderful. Okay, well, thanks for talking to us today, and good luck with the charity event. That's a great cause that you're doing. Great, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fantastic. I would love that. Is that okay?
Yes, we've already made arrangements for you to move around this year.
Are you excited to be a Dalek? Excited to get to be a Dalek?
This is probably one of the greatest moments of my life.
This is like a crazy crossover. This has never happened before. A Defiance Dalek crossover?
This is going to be a Dalek Lorekeeper. It's a new model. It hasn't existed before.
A handsome model.
Well, I think once we're in the suit, the great thing about being a Dalek is it's a great leveler. Once you're a Dalek, you're just another Dalek. Unless you're Davros.
Yeah.
Dalek.
Daleks are the best.
For the win, for Evs. Hook 'em high. Metal horns.
I'm standing right here.
Oh, dude. How are you?
Matt Smith has arrived.
He's about to enter the Dalek. He's getting ready. He's getting primed. This is exciting. What do you see?
Hitchhiker.
Hey.
What's this going on?
It's a teeny tiny Dalek.
Sneaking in at the back. We see you.
Oh, he's up to some mischief.
We got a Genesis Dalek just rolling by there. Like, not a care in the world. Like a mall walker.
This is a big thing. That's the only Australian.
So what's going on? Are we getting in?
He's going to climb in.
He's going to climb in,
yeah.
Isn't it? Oh, my. So we have, what, Australian Dalek?
I guess so, yeah, an Australian Dalek. That's a change, yeah.
I trust you. I'm
very claustrophobic. I'd be scared in there.
Doctor and Doctor could be a Dalek, I think.
Yeah, I know, but I'd be scared in there.
What's to be scared of, though?
It's too hemmed in. I'm too hemmed in.
Yeah, there's no tentacles or anything. It's made of plywood.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
But this is the main event here. We've got Star of Defiance climbing into a Dalek.
Star of Defiance. Looks like he's enjoying it. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I taught my boy, I'll show you later. I'm building Dalek for my youngest. And he was a Dalek 2 Halloweens ago. Thank you. So this is for him, essentially.
Okay, that's not on yet.
How do you press him?
Speakers are in the dome. So we have to...
Is it super loud once you're in there?
Lock you up. Yeah. All right.
It's going in.
Now, what they're going to do is they're all going to go home. That's right? And I'll be stuck in here forever.
Now, a little touch of Houdini.
Okay, do you need to hook him in anything else? Up here? Hold on.
You're scaring me.
Tell my kids I love them.
We'll see you again soon.
And the Daleks claim another slave. So you didn't tell them how to turn on the Mark Mondo.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. There's a little switch.
That's so cool. Once you
turn on that. That's fantastic. What's happening? Paint a picture here for us.
Well, we have an international star of defiance encased in a Dalek.
Okay, we're done.
Are you guys doing
crazy?
Podcast?
Yeah, we are.
Really?
Oh man. Are you a Doctor Who fan?
Can I be on the podcast?
Well now we're kind of in the middle.
We're in the middle of doing something.
Yeah, kind of doing something. Yeah, sorry. It's sort of a
B and but, C your way up. You know? Just like briefly, could I just give a shout out to my boys, well, my homies in Scarborough,
nice
Teesdale represent.
That's what I've got. Oh my God.
Exterminate 3 times.
Ah, nice.
Very yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good stuff.
Oh, I love this. Let's see. Oh, God. Hold on. Let me try something else. I'll have 2 pints of beer and a bourbon chaser. Can I please have a hamburger? I love it.
Did you want to say a message for your son?
Oh, wait.
You ready? You recording?
Yeah, we're good.
Ezekiel, this is Daddy. Daddy loves you. Daddy loves you. Daddy loves you.
Oh. Wow.
I'm in heaven.
So we're here with Brian McCarville, and he is the artist behind these lovely prints. Can you tell us about these prints for our listeners?
They are in a minimalist style.
Yes.
Which favors clean lines and crisp design. You want strong, bold colors.
Lots of blue, lots of white, I'm seeing. Do you always do sort of sci-fi themed art? I see you have some, like, it's a Firefly there, and some Star Trek, and Star Wars, Doctor Who.
I really just started doing the posters because I was fascinated by Comic-Con. I think it's the purest connection that people have to their stories.
Yeah.
It's the most honest. It's the most. It's the most real.
Yeah.
And the passion that you see in people, it's not doctored. It's, you know, you look at Star Trek. They have done everything in their power to kill the original Star Trek, and they cannot do it.
Yeah.
You know, complete with a 2009 movie that they spent over $100 million on that says, oh, remember all that other stuff? Remember 40 years of Star
Trek? Yeah, that did
that
happen.
Didn't happen.
Yeah. And so are you a big Doctor Who fan, too?
I'm a big Doctor Who fan. Okay. Of course I am.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Doctor, then?
I'm very torn between... Okay. Between
I won't make you pick just one. You can pick
four
two.
And ten.
Okay, that's a good split.
Yeah, four and
yeah,
ten.
I can see that. Four and ten. Yeah. Have you heard any of four's audio stuff?
His new I've stuff, heard his some.
It's really good.
And the remarkable thing about him is he's aged amazingly, except for his voice.
Yeah.
Which is exactly the same way as it was when he left the show in 82?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I went and I saw the release last year of the 50th anniversary, and of course, he makes this magnificent appearance.
It was magical, yeah.
I cried like a baby. Yeah.
Did you know it was coming?
No, I didn't.
Okay, I didn't either. It was a spoiler. I didn't know. Yeah.
It was wonderful. I saw it in a packed theater house, and there were people there who were 80 years old, and there were people there who were 8 years old. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And that's exactly why I love this stuff. It's so pure.
Well, you can see it in your art, too. I mean, your art is just, it's gorgeous. Where can people find it online?
They can find it online at my DeviantArt account.
Your DeviantArt account, okay, which is?
Machine Elf.
Yeah.
2014.
Okay.
That's my DeviantArt
Machine
account.
Machine Elf 2014.
What's going on, guys?
We're interviewing today. We are interviewing for the Who Wars podcast.
Yes, I know
And we are interviewing
Beth.
Hello, Beth. And Beth, I'm here with Andrew Chalmers, the Dark Journey Doctor. And I think he has some mysterious questions for you about all your lovely art.
Do I?
Yes, you do.
So here's one. Okay. So where do your inspirations come from?
My inspiration comes from everything. Movies, comics, pop art, anything from different genres from all across the board.
Interesting.
Interesting.
What's your favorite genre?
Sci-fi, most definitely.
Sci-fi.
You describe your art style for us. It's a very kind of... it's the normal characters, but they kind of look a little bit, I guess, like kids, kind of, yeah?
Yeah, I oversimplified. They're actually called chibi art and everything. I made them for my son's nursery because I couldn't find the characters I wanted, and it blew up. So I thought, I'm going to draw everybody like this.
It was an explosion?
It was an explosion.
The building exploded.
Kaboom.
That's terrible. I'm glad there was an explosion. That explains the scotch. That's a reference to an earlier conversation we had.
Which doesn't help our listeners because they weren't privy to that.
But it was awesome all the same. So go on and say a question then.
I've done all my questions. You're supposed to do your questions.
How are your feet?
Very sore.
Yeah. I've got shin splints.
Ask how the con's gone for.
How's the con gone for? I don't like saying con. It sounds like a swindle.
No, that's how they talk. That's how people talk when they're talking about conventions.
I'm not talking like a con man. I refuse to do it.
All right, well, you're doing the interview. Go, do it.
Okay, how is the con going for you?
The con is going wonderful. This is my second year doing it. Meeting all the people is wonderful, and I just want to keep doing it forever.
Really?
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, I think you've got a lovely range of stuff. Do you want to plug your website so people can order by mail?
Sure.
Mail?
You go to nightmaresanddaydreams.com on Facebook, and it's Nightmares with a K.
Ooh, sounds scary.
It is. It's a little bit dramatic.
Wow.
I'll just hold the business card up to the mic. Does it pick up?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't get pictures.
Even if I hold it like this?
No. Well, to the left.
Get yourself a better microphone.
Oh, sorry. Good? We got it. Okay, say goodnight, Beth.
Goodnight, Beth.
Goodnight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Clicking towards oblivion. How long can I?
Insufficient data.
Yeah, you never f***ing know the answer, but it's important.
1, 2, 3.
Sugar Plum Fairy.
That's how John Lennon counted in the recording of A Day in the Life in the studio.
Of course.
Instead of saying 1, 2, 3, 4, he went Sugar Plum Fairy.
That's it.
You see.
Which ties in, of course, with the sad loss of Cynthia Lennon.
Look at that. We've been back together in the room recording for less than a few seconds and we've already brought death into it.
Well, yes, well.
Old habits.
Old habits indeed.
Anyway,
hello.
Good to be back in the room with you, Al.
It is. It's nice. You've redecorated. I love it.
Thanks.
Because no one ever says that.
We're going to talk about something, aren't we?
We are, yeah.
In my head, I want to introduce it as a coming-of-age story. Because when you become 18, all of a sudden, I think you have to become a bit more serious and think more about the way you dress and look to more serious matters. Or that's meant to be the idea of it anyway.
Yeah.
We're talking about 18th here because, of course, Doctor Who had an 18th and came of age, didn't it, with season 18?
It did. Where it tried to grow up. That's it. I like
it. Did it.
I like what you've done.
It changed, didn't it?
Oh, very much, yes.
79, season 17, going into this season is when I first really, really started remembering every week of Doctor Who. And I find it interesting because a few Who Wars ago, I'd bought a copy of Spearhead from Space. Mm-hmm. I got the Blu-ray and watched it for the first time in a long time. And I was absolutely staggered at how remarkably different it was to the War Games. It was like a totally different series.
Yeah,
because I wasn't alive then, but I was when this change happened. So it's quite interesting thinking what I was like, a 7-year-old or whatever at the time, just noticing that change and remembering what it was like.
The jump between 17 and 18 is weird because when you look back on it, what you were saying there about not being alive when Spearhead from Space came on, we're both of us of a very similar age. It's only months sort of difference. So time sort of accelerates so much faster because you're changing so much during that run. Whereas when you hit your 18th, that's kind of it. That's kind of you're sort of fixed as to who you are. As far as your personality goes, you just get more experience from that point on and your body begins to fall apart because all the, as I've said elsewhere and elsewhere, all your dreams and colours, they're clearer and brighter than they'll ever be again because it's downhill after that. Your hearing goes, your sense of taste goes, you know, your memories start to fill up like silt and it's really interesting. But the jumps between the different seasons are so much more important because you are a different person to the one that you were. You've grown, you're taller, you know, the notches that you've got on the side of the door where they're measuring your height, you shoot up and you reach a point where you can grow a foot. With all the creaking and the groaning, where it's like a werewolf transformation, where your legs stretch and all your bones enhance and
move. Well, what if you're growing a foot?
Well, yes, I know.
Yeah.
Didn't everyone grow an extra foot? I had an ear on my back for a while, but that's because I was an experimental mouse. So I don't know. Because season 18 very much was very consciously attempting to be much more grown up, wasn't it?
Well, speaking as a 7-year-old at the time and speaking as a 41-year-old now, it's two very different answers. As somebody now who watches the DVDs and has read tons of episode guides and books and articles and watched DVD extras and things, of course there was a grown-up aspect to the writing. I've watched Full Circle today, which is all about evolution and science and DNAs mentioned and stuff. But as a 6 or 7-year-old, I didn't remember any of that. My memories of Full Circle when I was 7 were, wow, what a cool swamp thing with steam coming out of it. Wow, look at those ace monsters. I don't think I even remember the aspect about DNA. I certainly don't remember the fact that that was part of an E-Space trilogy. But as a kid, I didn't notice. And the same goes with the theme tune and the opening titles. I didn't know that the previous theme tune and opening titles had been there for God knows how many years.
Well, they'd been there forever. They'd always been those.
Yeah, I didn't know that. At this point in time, Doctor Who was just a teleprogramme that was on there and then. It didn't have a past. It might not have a future. It's just a teleprogramme and it's on. And you just watch it. And, you know, the theme tune change and the opening titles change didn't seem to even register with me as a child. Whereas now, you know, every series they'll tweak something or change a logo or something. The forums are alight with people going, oh, I hate it, don't like it, no, they shouldn't have changed that.
That's because no one likes getting older.
Well, this is it. I mean, if you mentioned it to a 6-year-old, they'd probably go, do you remember that the theme tune wasn't like that last series, wasn't it? Well, it sounded like it.
Yeah, exactly, because it's not important, is it? It's only when you start cataloguing it, yeah.
So I think at the time, I didn't really notice this huge, drastic change that you do notice now when you sort of watch these things on a loop or when you're constantly looking or thinking about these things.
Well, it's because we're observing it, and the act of observing the thing changes the thing. Because the first story that I remember watching, or the first memory that I've got, which I've gone on about a massive length before, is from The Invisible Enemy, which was sort of 3 years before this. Because that's my very, very earliest memory. And then I remember sort of sections and bits and moments and sort of things. And then The Key to Time, I remember snatched glances of it. When you hit season 17, that's when I actually start remembering episodes and watching episodes and Lala Ward as Romana and reading the novelizations of Creature from the Pit and Nightmare of Eden and Horns of Nymon. Both I read both novelizations one weekend when we were up at the caravan because I remember I had the books and I remember lying in the sun as the sun crept round reading them, and I read a Superman comic at the same time, but that's a story for another time.
Yeah.
And that was when I sort of really got into it, because I can remember Horns of Nymon and I can remember Nightmare of Eden going out, and I can remember watching it, and it just felt I can sort of remember the sense as to whether or not this is true, whether or not I'm making this memory up is another matter, because you know the memory it cheats, but it felt real. It felt dangerous, and it was almost like you were holding your breath from the end of the opening titles until the end titles, because you couldn't look at the clock to keep track of where you were in it. You just knew that any moment now it was going to end. That's what I got with the episodes of Doctor Who. I found it very exciting and very thrilling, and not knowing how long you had before it went. I really, really enjoyed season 17. And then when season 18 came round, and with Full Circle, and I remember when Full Circle was announced in the paper, because I was at the point where I was reading, you know, the paper and everything, because I was reading books and I was reading the paper by myself. And weirdly enough, and I don't think I've ever said this, the first newspaper story that I remember reading was about the introduction of a new character in Doctor Who, and this was Adric, and it was going on about the fact that the two people who were involved in the series that the story had concentrated on were both so incredibly young, and I was thinking, that's not an unachievable age for me, because it wasn't that far away from where I was, even though they still seemed impossibly old, which was weird.
Yes.
But it,
yeah, that's true, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, because it was at the stage where if you were writing a story about, if you're writing a comic or anything, you'd always make sure that the protagonists were no older than about 17 or 18, because that was about as far ahead in the future as you could imagine, because anything beyond that was essentially beginning to fossilize. I didn't enjoy season 18. I loved Full Circle. I loved State of Decay, thinking back on it. What else did I like? Warrior's Gate, I didn't really get. Keeper of Traken, I just found really dull. It was like going to a Shakespeare thing. Legopolis was tedious. Megalos didn't have as good a jungle as Creature from the Pit. And the Leisure Hive was just like Crown Court. This is just my initial memories of it. It was just looking at it now, these were exciting and very, it was very different. But back then, it just all went maths.
Yeah, it was very sciencey, wasn't it? And very...
It was just...
serious when you actually look at it now. Yeah.
There was no fun. You know, it was kind of like the fun had all been sponged out of it in order to make it grow up. Horns and Nymon I loved, but I can see why people would be worried about it, because Graham Crowden's obviously having a whale of a time, but people aren't... They're not taking it seriously. But it's not necessarily that Tom Baker's not taking it seriously, in fairness to him, because he didn't add that sound effect in the TARDIS... You know, and he wasn't responsible. Although he does try and make people crack up, it's up to them to rein that in themselves, isn't it? And then the next time round, with a new title sequence, he looks exhausted.
Yeah, he does.
And russety and old and autumnal, and he's hidden away like a tortoise that just wants to sleep on a beach at the start of that scene before K-9 hurls himself desperately into the sea. You know, in the Leisure Hive, it's weird. And now it looks really adventurous, but at the time it just turned me off it. It really did.
With Graham Crowden,
yeah,
he was a mate of Tom Baker's.
Ah,
and who's the guy in Full Circle? The guy who was who played a detective on telly, George.
Oh, George Baker, is it?
George Baker. Apparently, he was an old drinking buddy of Tom. If there's a buddy of Tom's on set, or someone Tom gets on with, apparently the atmosphere is totally different, and there's a certain sort of electricity that's flowing there.
I am going to have to say something about Full Circle, because Full Circle is a very important story for me, not just because I really liked it, because it's very well made, and it's still well written, you know, even after all the years have faded away and drifted, it's got a strength to it. Yeah. Problem I got with Full Circle is that Full Circle was, apart from the fact that it was a season that I wasn't too keen on, I loved the story. I've got good memories of it being really frightening, and the way it was put together being very exciting. And I think I can still remember, but again, as we said, the memory cheats. I can remember the whole bit about the vivisection of the Marsh Child being just really, oh, but it's just a child. And that cut through everything, as it were, you know, bad example of words. But the problem I had was that I, at the time and now, looked like Adric. Like,
really?
Absolutely the spit. So,
yeah.
I
can't see it myself. It'll never catch up.
But I did, you know, yeah. See what you did there. But that's not just been me making that up. I did. It's like to the point where people were commenting on it years later in repeats on UK Gold. It was just like, ooh, doesn't he look like Al? Can we not do that? Which, you know. So if ever I had the opportunity to, I should probably thank somebody for that.
I don't even know if I've made this up. So you might have to to bring me back down to earth with this one.
I'll come up with a weird connection.
I'm fairly sure that quite a lot of times people have a dig at JNT,
yeah,
for taking over the show, and they didn't like what he did to the show with the, you know, the flashy titles and the flashy logo and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I've often heard people quote that, oh well, of course it's all because of Star Wars. These films had orchestral soundtracks. John Nathan Turner brought in synthy soundtracks.
Yeah, it wasn't orchestral. John Nathan Turner wanted to drag the series screaming and mewling into the 80s.
I think that it's got more in common with Top of the Pops than it
has. Do you know, that's exactly what I was going to say. Because the innovations that... Because innovations would take place on Top of the Pops that would then be translated across to Doctor Who. And they'd all be borrowing the equipment from the sports department. The only department that had anything that could sort of pause and rewind things was for football matches, you know. So, but you're right. The innovations came from the change in culture that was occurring outside in the wider world that was being represented with music.
The other thing that I really like, another thing that I think Austin raises this, is that some people don't like the Starfield opening titles, and
really?
So we want our kaleidoscope tunnel of strange eerie camera things back. We want a tunnel. I remember liking the opening titles at the time. I wasn't really bothered about a change, like I said. But now that I'm older, and this is something I do, I just, if I'm outside and it's dark and I look up in the sky and I see stars, it blows me away. It just stops me in my tracks just thinking, how tiny are we? It just makes you feel that this is huge, and we're looking up at it. And my, it's sort of now thinking metaphorically, that's what those opening titles do for me. With this Starfield, suddenly this program isn't just sort of, it almost feels confined and claustrophobic being in that tunnel. Whereas this, you're suddenly thinking, wow, this is all of time and space. We could go anywhere, and it's sort of almost got a scariness to it, you know.
I remember it snowing in during a playtime when we were allowed out when it snowed, because this was before health and safety. You know, this is back when actors were allowed to ride on top of trains. Just running through it and looking up, and it was like running into stars, you know, and that, not trying to catch them on your tongue, because it was, and it was sort of the opening titles to Doctor Who. The time tunnel was in its own way is amazing and beautiful, but I only have a kind of a very vague memory of that compared to the Starfield and that opening screech and the end supernova. You know, when you can see the gunk at the back of your eyes when it goes so white and it just goes boom, the thoom. I remember that, but the because to think about it, not only the speed that you would have to be traveling through for those stars, you know, to be moving at that pace, that's one thing. For them to form the Doctor's face, that's something else. That says something about the character that I think gets forgotten, that doesn't happen when you've got someone like John Pertwee appearing in a tunnel.
Crudely cut out.
JNT, for whatever, he did, it modernised it. It was much more modern.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I think he did a fantastic job, and I think that he was he's a role model for current showrunners in the way that you promote it and you manage it and you take it out to the world. Just to let you know, I'm heading to a segue to complete this now.
Seamless. So, go on.
I'm just saying that in case you've got anything else that I don't want you to be left frustrated because you never got to say anything about something.
What I'd like to say is that K-9 had a rough deal in season 18 because everyone picked on him. Leisure Hive, he commits suicide by water. Megalos, people are only appearing in it on the condition that they get to kick the dog. Full Circle, he gets his head lopped off and paraded around, you know, like some sort of like a skull on a stick. State of Decay, well, you know, and Warrior's Gate, he gets abandoned because he's wandered through a mirror. Yeah, I know.
He does have a very good chase sequence in a swamp. In Full Circle,
he's good in that. Yes, you can hardly see the wire.
One of the bits of Full Circle that I did want to mention earlier, when we were talking about how there was this seriousness had come over it, and that Tom had been reined in.
Yeah,
there's a bit where Tom, the Doctor, has K-9's head in front of his own face and he's barking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that scene is the one that Tom improvised and put in. And I have sort of heard quite a bit of snobbiness from production people about that. Well, we let him have his way a little bit, didn't we, to keep him quiet, as though it's, yeah, we'll just let him do that. Where in actual fact, that is pure Fourth Doctor. And he's brilliant in that scene. So maybe there's something about, you know, maybe we shouldn't try and be so sensible and put these things on us when we come of age.
I think you're right. I think you need to allow for the spark, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm glad that Tom did that.
Mm.
But also, speaking of coming of age, you're gonna love this. This is broadcasting gold dust.
Go on.
Speaking of coming of age, the writer of Full Circle, who was Andrew Smith,
yes,
who was the youngest person ever to write for Doctor Who, and he actually celebrated his 18th birthday on location at the filming of his story. So, just how did this young man get to write for Doctor Who? Thanks for chatting. All right, that one's it.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Smashing.
Do I get some cake?
No.
There's never any cake.
K-9 sort of polarizes people, really. It's a love him or hate him relationship.
It's part of that, oh, but it's a kids program thing. And what fun we can call him K-9. And there's a little pun in there that the smarter children may get. I hated all this.
I love K-9 and I feel quite defensive about K-9. I hated the attitude to K-9. I think it went with the moving it away from small children thing.
I wasn't a fan of K-9. I'm sure I always intended that one way or another he was going to be disappearing from the story for a while.
So we're both recording. Marvellous. Do correct me as I go along with my awful Wikipedia. We're going to come in with the old classic, I'm afraid, Andrew. At the age of 18, you
17.
Wrote... Sorry, yes, there we go. I've already corrected that from 19. Yes. There's the outset.
Yeah.
So at the age of 17, you wrote, submitted a script for Doctor Who, had it commissioned and made, starring my favourite Doctor Tom Baker. Andrew Smith, how on earth did you get to that point in your life?
To keep it short, persistence and the help and advice of some very kind people, and luck. Definitely, I think, being in the right place at the right time. But mainly, I'd been submitting ideas into Doctor Who and other TV programmes and radio as well for about 3 years before that. And I'd had, about 2 years before, I'd had my first thing that I'd written anywhere produced, which was comedy sketches on a British BBC radio comedy sketch show called Weekending with David Jason. But I've been writing since I could kind of hold a pencil, I think, really. Got a typewriter as a Christmas present when I was about 7 or 8 and never looked back. And I used to record all sorts of programmes off the air and write them up as prose. Doctor Who, but also all sorts of programmes, including Shoestring and The Sweeney. So I was sending ideas into Doctor Who. I sent a couple of scripts into Doctor Who, one to Robert Holmes, one to Anthony Reid. They were all rejected, but with some very, very positive criticism and some really, really good notes. And then I sent in a couple of storylines to Douglas Adams, one of which was The Planet That Slept, that became Full Circle. And apparently with each of these script editors, when they handed over, that I was flagged up as one to watch, someone with promise. And then Chris Bidmead, script editor, you know, it's all Whovians listen to this podcast, Chris Bidmead in early 1980, was the script editor, the incoming script editor on Doctor Who, and he picked up this storyline that I'd sent to Douglas Adams, who'd been the script editor the year before, and liked it, and particularly liked the world I described, this world with the cycles of the mists coming in and the marshmen coming out of the marsh and all that sort of thing, and the ecology of the world. And so he invited me down, having first of all said that I live too far away to be able to practically do it. He said, come down and we'll talk about writing and getting into writing. And then he seemed to forget that in between times, because when I walked in the office at Shepherd's Bush, this was February 1980, he said, what we're thinking of doing is commissioning you for the first episode. And then if we like that, then we'll commission the other three. So I did that. I did a scene breakdown and a script for episode one, sent it away, was on tenterhooks for a week, and then I got the phone call. I was in the kitchen, I remember, and back at home in Glasgow, and got the phone call from Chris saying, we love it, we'd like the other three, please. And it was fantastic. I was jumping around. Yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing just doesn't happen these days, does it? I mean, you know.
Well, that particular experience couldn't happen now. You cannot send things in and get them read if you know, just on spec, because it's, you know, it's a litigious society now. We just weren't wired that way back in 1980. Yeah, but I think, you know, in terms of the thing that's still true today is sticking at it. And you'll get things rejected, but to deal with that in a positive way. Listen to, well, hopefully when things are rejected, you'll be as lucky as I was that when it's people like Robert Holmes and Anthony Reid and Douglas Adams, that when you send something back, they'll actually attach some notes to it. And Anthony Reid, the script I sent him, he'd gone all the way through it with a pencil, filled it with notes, which was absolutely fabulous. I wish I still had it. I don't. It was lost when my parents moved house after I've moved to London, but, you know, absolutely fabulous, priceless advice and encouragement.
Just, I was very interested to hear you say that you'd listen to things like The Sweeney and type them out.
Mm.
And what's interesting, when I watch a TV show, I totally submerge myself in everything about it, the writing, the music, the lighting, the acting.
Mm.
Were you peeling away specifically the written element and typing that up? Or when you're writing it or typing it, are you hearing incidental music in your head? Are you seeing things visually? Or do you focus away from that as a writer?
I think you do kind of see the whole picture as you write it, for whatever the medium is. And I think really you have to do. I think it's important to understand technically how things are made. And that's why, I mean, when Big Finish asked me to write my first thing for them, I said to David Richardson, the producer, look, can I come along and to the studios and just, you know, sit in a recording? But that helped, you know, just seeing the setup in the studio, which is quite different from the BBC radio recording that I was used to writing for back in the early 80s. It just helps. But it also helps understand the medium as it's broadcast, either on disc, digital download, or radio, or TV, or cinema, whatever it is you're doing.
So did Full Circle look on TV as it did in your head?
Well, I think, better, I think. But the thing we're doing TV, and I remember the thing we're doing TV is that there are more creative influences on the finished product than there are on an audio product, whether that's a CD audio, digital download, or radio. There are more creative processes on hand, and not just for mine, but others. I mean, I remember I read the script for Megalos as part of my preparation for writing Full Circle, and I was quite surprised by how that looked when I saw it. It just wasn't what I had in my head at all. And other stories as well, you know, and I've spoken to a writer on the New Who. You know, I mentioned that the Marshmen didn't look like I had envisaged them, you know, because I'd seen them as being more like cavemen types. And he said, actually, the monsters in his story didn't look like he'd imagined them either. You know, so that's a common thing, but not unsurprising when you think, you know, you don't want to constrain creative people when you write either, and you want costume designers and makeup designers and visual and special effects designers and directors and everybody to bring, you know, what they can to tell the story in the best, most interesting way, and usually flattering what you've written. And definitely in the case of Big Finish Audio, that happens every time. That it just blows me away what the guys do and the girls do with what I put on the page.
Talking there about production and the production teams involved, you were doing Full Circle at a time when there was quite a big changeover on the TV series with John Nathan Turner coming in, and because it was Tom's last season, John Nathan Turner's often accused of killing the show, which I'm sure you've heard before, and I couldn't disagree with it more. When I read articles about him or talk to people about him who've known him or got anecdotes about him, he seems to be one of the most generous, giving men, for giving people opportunities, and he was genuinely passionate about Doctor Who. And obviously, he gave you a great opportunity, so
he absolutely did. And he and Chris are people for whom I'm eternally grateful. John as well, I mean, that season, he just brought in a new vision that completely revitalised and I think probably saved the programme at the time.
I think so, yeah.
I put it in a new direction. Certainly for the 2 years previously, there'd been a perception from the production team that they were writing for children. And for season 18, we were not writing for children. We were writing for at least young adults. Certainly children were in the set of the audience, but the principal audience, I think, for what we were writing was at least young adults in early 20s, with an appeal to the whole, you know, to the whole family, not for children. And so we didn't have things like, you know, the silly noises coming out of the TARDIS console, the Horns of Nymon, which again, some of your listeners might be available to, but it's like the TARDIS console explodes and there's a spring going boing and there's a car horn and, you know, and all that sort of thing. That was something that was never going to happen under John Nathan Turner's tenure. And I remember, I mean, my first script meeting was me, Chris and John, and John very firm about what he wanted, and I loved everything I heard from him, you know, and about realism as well, you know, and not overstretching ourselves with effects and that sort of thing. And in terms of generosity, I remember a thing where I between the two recording blocks in August 1980, we had an insurance guy that came to the house who mentioned, you found out about the Doctor Who thing, and he mentioned he had a nephew suffering from Down syndrome who's a big Doctor Who fan. And I looked this up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, we didn't have the internet, and saw what an appalling condition it was, and mentioned this to John in the studio when I came down. And he said, hang on, I'll be back. And he came back, and he had several bits of merchandise. He had a Doctor Who annual for that year that hadn't been published at that point. And he said, give these to him. And he had a Polaroid camera. And he said, go around the set, get photographs of the cast, and we'll get them autographed, and you can take them to him as well. So I did that. I remember taking a photograph of Matthew outside the TARDIS, actually. And he autographed that, and I got all this stuff, and I took it back. And again, so this guy brought his nephew around the house when I got back. I said, here you are, there's all this stuff. And there's the stuff signed by Tom Baker, by Lala Ward, by Matthew Waterhouse. Here's the annual that nobody else has got yet, signed by everybody, by the Doctor. And he was like, wow, you know, fantastic. But that was John, you know.
Yeah.
I hadn't suggested it to him. I just told him about this kid. And he said, oh, I've got an idea, you know.
Yeah, I think he's almost a role model for the current showrunners of how to behave. Because he was very public and would go on chat shows and interviews, which, you know, directors and producers never used to do, whereas now that is very much the norm.
What was happening at that time is more like television, certainly television throughout daylight hours was becoming more the norm, not something that would start at lunchtime. So John and others would tend to turn up on Saturday morning kids shows and that sort of thing and become known. And John made himself accessible, I suppose, in a way that other producers hadn't. I know there's a suggestion later on that maybe that overtook things a bit with like going off to conventions and things like that during production time. But I knew John, you know, and I met John later. I was about 3 years later when I was working on The First Centaurians as a script. And I was in the studio when they were recording Resurrection of the Daleks and met John then and met him a couple of other occasions. And I just remain just very impressed with him. Very impressed with him.
So after all this amazing experience of writing for Doctor Who, was then it, you know, showbiz parties and royalty checks and movie premieres?
No. It was. I moved on and did other things. I went on and wrote a TV play called Thieves. Mm-hmm. Very shortly after, about some shoplifters. Shortly after that, which is something I knew about because I'd had a Saturday job with us. Kind of a Saturday Story Detective thing.
Oh, right.
So I wrote a play about that, and which starred Michael Sheard.
Excellent.
And David McHale, who'd been the sergeant in Talons of Wen Chiang.
Yeah.
And John McGlynn in one of his early roles. And a certain young actress called Elaine Collins, who went on to be Mrs. Peter Capaldi. I think she was about 22, 23 at the time. And she was lovely, absolutely lovely. I did radio dramas and I did quite a lot of comedy work, comedy sketches.
Yeah.
Not the 9 o'clock news, Viva Kine, Kick Up the 80s, I was a staff writer on. And which Peter Capaldi, I recently found out, did graphic design for. In fact, last night I was I'm visiting family in Glasgow at the moment. I live in London, but I'm visiting family in Scotland at the moment. And last night I was out with friends, one of whom is a graphic designer, and I found out that Peter Capaldi was not only graphic designer on Kick Up the 80s when I worked on it, he was also a graphic designer on a one-off topical comedy show that I was a writer and researcher on in 1981 called 81 Take 2. So there's every chance, actually, that we met up, because, you know, these things would always finish up with going to the BBC bar in Glasgow, the Slange Bar, around the corner from Broadcasting House, and I met Peter Capaldi once at a convention and chatted, and if we meet again, I'll ask him whether he thinks the chances are we met up. But small world.
Then you moved on from writing, though, didn't you? You took a bit of a turn.
Yeah. Well, after 4.5 years, yeah.
And what was his career turn? Was it?
I joined the police. I joined the Metropolitan Police in London.
Okay. Mm. So the inspiration from the Sweeney and being a store detective led to the police work.
And the inspiration, when I was still at school, when I was about 16 or 17, Strathclyde Police had come in the school and just given a career talk.
Yeah.
And we used, you know, we get a lot of these, but that was the one I thought, I quite fancy that. Yeah.
I'm aware that you had a long and enjoyable time in the police force.
Yeah, very. Yeah, I was very lucky.
At any point in that time while you were in the police, did you have a desire to write anymore, or did you keep an extra notebook in your pocket for future potential ideas?
I did, and I you know, I've got notebooks full of stuff and somewhere I need to dig out, and but also again, computers came in the mid 90s, and then, you know, stuff on was on floppy disk and whatnot, you know, and I had a Scion. I was on surveillance for 9 years, and I used to sit there with, I remember, a little Scion 3, you know. Yeah. Riding on a blooming Scion in the car, you know.
Yeah.
But often with very little time in surveillance. For me, I was on a team that we worked all over the country and did long hours at short notice, and I would leave the house, you know, maybe 5 o'clock one morning and say I'll be back at four to my wife, and then she wouldn't see me for 2 weeks, and that wasn't unusual. So in terms of actually doing it professionally, right, it would have been out of the question at that time. But absolutely fantastic line of work. Very, very rewarding. And I just feel I've been so lucky. You know, I thought, having retired last September, I just been so lucky. I would not change a thing. I was very lucky to have had the experience and the exposure to writing that I did at the age that I did, the experience that I got. And then I joined the police. I was just so lucky. I was so lucky with my first posting to Brixton. I was there for 5 years and then joined Special Branch in 89. And spent most of the next 25 years in counterterrorism.
Wow.
At the end of the 90s, people were trying to convince me to leave counterterrorism, that it, you know, the IRA had gone away, basically, you know, and it was all settling down, and security service were looking at narcotics to keep themselves going as a threat to national security. And I put off promotion, and then 9/11 happened, and it all completely became the very best place to be working, in terms of rewards and working on jobs that saved lives and lots of lives, you know, just absolutely fantastic. It took me around the world, and I loved every minute of it.
Some of those aspects now that give you, I don't know, an almost scary insight into some of the things that are reported on the news that we're all exposed to these days.
No, not scary. I think it'd be scarier not to know actually what's happening, because it's actually reassuring, because I think, having worked in it for so long, and I did a job for a few years which was my job to be involved with, like, assessing the threat, to be honest, it's kind of reassuring, because the effort that goes into protecting us from terrorism is immense. We can live with the odd number of armed robberies. We can even accept, if you like, that we cannot prevent every murder, but the effort in counterterrorism is to stop every terrorist attack. And although prominent police and politicians, everyone will say, you know, we cannot stop, but what we are trying to do, and kind of, well, I'm not involved anymore, what we were trying to do, the aim is always to stop it every time. It's when the flying squad will accept, oh, there's an armed robbery, whatever, but, you know, if there's a terrorist attack, it's like, how did that happen? How did that get past us? And there have been an awful, awful lot that have been stopped. And it's just so rewarding to be any part of stopping that sort of thing.
It is good to hear that sort of thing, because it's often the negativity that is reported in any kind of news, isn't it? And so we don't hear things like that.
Yeah. It's nice as well. Again, I've retired. I see things in the press and I think, okay, I'd be concerned about that. And other things I read in the press, I think, nonsense. Those people don't know what they're talking about. And but there are a lot of scare stories out there that actually are just people following their own agenda. Anyway, were we talking about Doctor Who?
I don't know. I didn't expect to go for that tangent.
this is like when I was at Gallifrey One 2 years ago. I was interviewed by Tony Lee on stage, and I think he might be policing in there. And I said, any questions? People lined up to ask questions, and one question was, did you carry a gun? Yes, I did. I did. I was a farms officer for 8 years, and I did. When I was on surveillance, I carried a gun. Okay. Then next question. Do you ever shoot anybody? No. Didn't even shoot anybody. No. Did it a couple of times. Didn't shoot anybody. And it's like, oh, we're talking about Doctor Who. Hello. Welcome to the Doctor Who. Oh, no. I said, welcome to the Doctor Who convention. Yeah.
As you said, you retired from the police force, but sort of towards the end of that career, somehow, like Doctor Who has a tendency of doing, it came back. How on earth did that happen?
That was, my plan was always, I always thought, you know, with policing, the type of policing I did as a specialist was just so time consuming that I thought I'd just leave it to the end of my career and then maybe prepare myself in the last year and then get back into it and sort of send stuff out, get an agent, blah, blah, or look to get an agent or whatever. But then what happened in 2009, early 2009, I think it was, the DVD of Full Circle, the East Base trilogy, came out. On the back of that, I was asked to go to a Doctor Who convention in Glasgow, my first one in over 30 years. And trying to think it was 2009 or 2010, I think it was 2009, might be 2010. But anyway, asked to go to this convention. When I was there, Big Finish were there, Nick and Jason and David. Nick Briggs, Jason Haygallery, Dave Richardson, for listeners who don't know them. And yeah.
Can I just ask if you can just elaborate, just in case, but who on earth are Big Finish?
Right, Big Finish are the audio equivalent of the BBC, basically, if you think in terms of putting Doctor Who dramas out there. Since 1999, they've been producing full cast audios of Doctor Who dramas, and over the years have enlarged as well into other particularly cult programmes like Dark Shadows, Blake 7...
Survivors,
absolutely fantastic. Judge Dredd and others. But the predominant thing has always been Doctor Who. I mean, I discovered the audios in 1999, shortly after they started. When, you know, I was just delighted driving along the motorway, stopped to pick up an audiobook to listen to, and found one of the first audiobooks, you know, or two of the first audiobooks, Whispers of the Dead, Land of the Dead and Winter for the Adept, two early Peter Davison titles. And I was just delighted. And then I just kept getting them and became a big fan of Big Finish. And they had stories written, they've had stories written by Mark Gatiss and that over the years and others. Gareth Roberts and others have gone on to write for Paul Cornell. We've gone on to write for the show. But anyway, you know, in my case, so I was at this convention and saw the three top guys at Big Finish, Jason, Nick and David. And David had a particular conversation with me around First Centaurans, which is a story that I'd had commissioned in 1983, I think it was, to write for Colin Baker that wasn't produced, it got to Scene Breakdown stage. We had a discussion about that and I said, I don't think the BBC will let you do it because it's about the origins of the Centaurans. And anyway, long story short, David then got in touch a couple of months later and said, would you like to write an audio for us, part of the range called The Companion Chronicles, with the Fourth Doctor, Tom Baker, narrated by Lala Ward as Romana, set in eSpace. And I said, yeah. So I did that. And then that led to doing a full cast production of that Lost story of mine, The First Centaurans, which the BBC were happy for us to do. And really since then, I haven't looked back. I've done about a dozen, I think about 10 out. I've written about a dozen. I'm writing two or three at the moment.
You seem to be a go-to writer, which must be a big compliment, I think.
Well, it is nice. There's quite a range of writers. It is lovely. Always lovely to be asked to do something. And it always excites me. You know, David will come to me and say, you know, would you like to do something for this Doctor, or would you like to do something for this new range we're doing, or have you heard of Survivors? God, yes, I've heard of Survivors. Yes, I saw it. Oh, my God. I watched that first broadcast.
The first Sontarans, which I am having a re-listen to at the moment, there seems to be a lot of dialogue packed into, particularly the first episode of that story. Is that deliberate because you knew it was going to be audio, or was a lot of that existing still from your breakdowns and what you were going to put on telly originally? Because it seems to be jam-packed in there.
There were samples of dialogue from the scene breakdown. I mean, I did change it, because the scene breakdown, if we'd gone to script in 1983, that would have changed anyway. It would have become something a little different. And one of the things I did, there was a strong story thread featuring the Mary Celeste in the original scene breakdown and storyline, which I'd never been happy with. But again, it kind of contradicted what had gone before in the chase, and no one knew about the chase. No one in the office nor me knew about the chase in 1983. No one, you know, and Ian Levine wasn't, you know, hadn't seen anything, and I didn't even know his name at the time. So when I came to do it, I thought, well, it contradicts it, and I wasn't very happy about including the Mary Celeste at the time anyway. So I made that a space orbiter, which is what it is in the First Centaurans audio now. And so I edited myself, and so what you've got is it's something that represents what may well have turned up on screen. But obviously with the audio, I think it's just the dialogue and any of these audios is, if this was a TV program, would the audio be the same? And I want the audio to be the same, whether it's audio or visual or TV, you know.
Your latest available release is Mistfall.
Yes. It's a sequel to Full Circle. So Full Circle, Tom Baker, Romana and K-9 finish up, going through a CD and finishing up in eSpace, where they are for three stories. And this has kind of happened again. It's the Fifth Doctor, Nyssa, Tegan and Turlough, and they're on the way somewhere else to see Nyssa's daughter, and they go through a CVE, and it turns out to be a really good reason for this, which is to do with, it happens earlier, it's to do with Adric calculating a way back into eSpace. There you go, right.
And is Adric in it as well?
No, he's not in it. No Adric, I'm afraid. He's toast. Unfortunately, if I could have done it, there's so many. If I could have found a way to get Richard Willis as Varsh back into it as well, I would have loved to have done it. But this is set sometime after the events of Full Circle.
Before we confuse people anymore that we're just discussing that, you did just mention Nyssa's daughter there. So is this the older version of Nyssa, that Big Finish of?
That's right. So Nyssa has left, and then she's met back up with his crew, and she's rejoined them as an older Nyssa. Yeah, and in the meantime, she's had a daughter, and she's had a son who, rather confusingly, she's called Adric. And rather lovely as well, that she's called Adric. There's a very... in Mistfall, it's just a very fleeting mention right at the start. They're on the way to see her daughter. But they finish up back on Alzarius, the planet that slept, and they have to find out if Mistfall's coming. So they pair up and go off and walk into her adventure, and they discover some of the characteristics of the planet that we'll recognise. They'll also come across none other than Gemma Redgrave as decider Lana Merion, who are on Alzarius to conduct some tests, and things are going wrong. There's going to be some sabotage going on, and it might be Outlers, it might be somebody else that's responsible for it. So that's the story, and I think that's just about enough to be going on with.
I'm gonna ask you something, and I obviously know that you aren't allowed to go beyond the press release, which I totally love and respect.
I think I know what this is going to be about. Yeah, go on.
But it'll be nice for the people out there to know exactly what I'm talking about. You mentioned Gemma Redgrave there.
Yeah.
Big Finish have landed themselves quite a major and exciting little deal.
Very.
And they're going to be making their first new series.
Yes, very exciting.
Yes, which is Unit.
Unit.
Extinction.
Unit Extinction, yes.
And I've noted on the website that it says written by Andrew Smith, and I'm guessing that's you.
Written by me and Matt Fitton.
Yes.
Matt's doing two episodes, I'm doing two. In fact, I've just been finishing off the drafts of episode three today. I've pretty much completed the other episode that I've written, and it's all looking very exciting, I've got to say.
This is the official tie-in with the new series featuring Kate Stewart. Kate Stewart.
Yeah.
And it does look marvellous, and I'm sure you can't tell us much else. How does it feel to be working on that?
Good. I mean, I did need a bit of redirection at one point in terms of the change of tone and the difference between this. This is very different from other things that Big Finish have done, and it is very much in line with the new series. And we've got Unit up against the Autons. If you go to the Big Finish website, bigfinish.com, you'll see a lovely graphic there featuring Kate Lethbridge-Stewart. Autons in the background, the Tower of London headquarters. And it's a big story of the Big Threat, and it's been lovely to play with.
Are they nesting tentacles as well that are on there, or just alien tentacles? But they're glorious.
I can confirm they are nesting tentacles.
Oh, exclusive there.
There you go.
Yeah. I think it's really exciting because, I mean, again, it's one of those things that could well be rumour or could well be just an exaggerated story, but I'm led to believe that a lot of the smaller companies who had Doctor Who licences in 2005... could all have potentially lost them when the BBC decided to make the series again. But Russell C. Davis and the production team went about and saved a few of them. And luckily, Big Finish kept its license, and look at it now.
It's a very... Big Finish is a very, very trusted holder of the BBC license. It really is. And I know... because everything I write with a Doctor Who tag on it, it goes to Cardiff. Big Finish send it off to Cardiff for approval. And I know even before it goes, Big Finish are very careful about things like use of language, behaviour, characters and everything, just to make sure it's consistent and is very consistent with the Doctor Who brand, if you like, but also, what it means to the people that care about it. Because Big Finish is a company populated by people who just love Doctor Who and associated properties, you know. And I've grown up with it, you know. A lot of them are around my age as well. We've all been through that thing of, like, being young kids at primary and secondary school, just cannot wait for the Saturday night in the 70s, and had our little recording devices in front of the TV, and we'd hit those two buttons just as the theme tune was starting up. You know, we were kids then in our rooms recording Doctor Who, Tom Baker in particular, and now produce this stuff and others as well. I mean, you know, you mentioned Survivors earlier. I was so pleased to be asked to do that as a Terry Nations title. I absolutely love it. The realism and the environment of it and the theme of it, and just a lovely, lovely, lovely thing to work on.
I'd like to thank you very much for your time, Andrew, and for telling us about your projects. I'm going to be a rip-off merchant here and pinch an idea of another podcaster we both look up to, which is Toby Haydock, who always asks his contributors to nominate a charity, because it's been very kind of you to give us out your time. And I'm very aware you've got a charity close to your heart. So if we could possibly mention that to all the listeners, hopefully they can have a look at it and raise a bit of awareness.
That's very kind of you to mention that. And I didn't know you were going to mention that, but it's the Lily Foundation, which is numeral 4 Lily Foundation, Lily Foundation, on Twitter. And I think it's Lily Foundation, or thelilyfoundation.org online. And it's basically it's a charity that it's an organisation that works to find a cure for mitochondrial disease. It's named after Lily, who was a little girl who died when she was 8 months old. If she hadn't died, she'd have gone to school with my little girls. It was absolutely heartbreaking, actually, to sort of hear that, you know, Lily wasn't going to make it. But the Lily Foundation has been founded in her name, and it's doing marvellous work. And it's done a lot of work in having breakthrough in British law recently as well. That's been all the press about mitochondrial donation, which has been fantastic. But any and all support to the Lily Foundation is very gratefully received and done in a very, very, very good cause.
Well,
thank you,
Andrew. Thank you very much for that, and thank you very much for taking time to talk to us. I have to end with one last question, I'm afraid.
I'm sure it's
going to be a very quick answer, because I'm contractually obliged to ask you, Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Doctor Who.
marvelous.
Hang on. No. Can I just add something to that?
You can. Duh. You can. No, some people don't like to. Some people like to leave it.
No. Yeah. Star Wars. Don't tell me about Star Wars. Actually, Star Wars, I saw Star Wars, I think it was either the day it came out in the UK or the day after, and then I saw it three times that week. And it was fantastic. Yes. And kids, it's not that thing that George Lucas revisited and put the giant Jabba the Hutt in. No.
And it wasn't called Episode 4 or anything, was it? It was just called Star Wars.
It is only called Star Wars. This Star Wars A New Hope, I don't know what that is. That's something that TV companies shove out there or something. But Star Wars was that film that came out in the... When was it, 77? Was it 77?
77, yeah, it came out in the UK in 78. There used to be a bit of a gap.
And I remember the huge build-up to it. And there's a Sunday newspaper had a thing about it. This is this new big thing coming called Star Wars. And there's a picture of... Han Solo and Obi-Wan and Luke Skywalker and Chewbacca and the flight deck of the Millennium Falcon, and it was absolutely fantastic, but it wasn't Doctor Who. and it bred Buck Rogers, and it bred all that nonsense that sort of looked good with its namby-pamby fancy special effects on ITV that sort of took some of our viewers away. Yeah. That wasn't half as good.
Yeah, but where are they?
Where are they now? Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, no, Star Wars fans, be happy, but we've got the better end of the deal.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Honoured by your visit to Lothal.
My visit is hardly an honour, Minister.
I admit I was surprised to learn you were coming.
And I too have been surprised by what's been happening on your little backwater world.
If you are referring to the insurgents, I...
In the absence of Governor Price, you have had a single, simple objective, Minister, to protect the Empire's industrial interest here, interests which are vital to our expansion throughout the Outer Rim. But instead of protecting those interests, you have allowed a cell of insurgents to flourish right under your nose. Am I correct?
Welcome to Rebels Roundup with Jonathan and Alan. With the end of Season 1 of Rebels, we just wanted to take a few minutes here on Who Wars and discuss our feelings of the series after the fact and kind of give you some of our opinions. And hopefully we won't have to wait too long for Season 2. So, Alan, I guess we'll start with you, as I'm the one asking. What was your favorite episode this year?
Can I say two? I have two that stick right at the top for me. Fire Across the Galaxy has to be right there near the top for me, but I think probably my favorite one or group cluster of ones was the right there in the middle when Ezra goes into the temple, the Jedi temple.
Oh, you're stealing my one. Path of the Jedi.
Path of the Jedi, yes. And I really liked the way that one got set up even previously when Ezra taps into his dark side. But those two, Fire Across the Galaxy and Path of the Jedi, are right at the top for me. I have a hard time finding any others that would really even match their intensity for me.
Well, I'll pick Path of the Jedi, but then I'll give you a different one as another option. So... for me, Path of the Jedi was probably my favorite episode simply because it brought back Yoda, and not just Yoda, but Frank Oz Yoda, which, you know, it's not to make any criticism towards Tom Kane, who played Yoda during the Clone Wars. I think he did a very credible job as Yoda. He's done a very credible job for a number of years as Yoda. But the honest truth of the matter is, the first actor who ever played a role, you have a tendency to associate them with that role. So even if they do take away from that person later, you still have that association. And so having Frank Oz in that particular role was, I think, huge. And I think the discussions that they had during that were very interesting. It was a very interesting and unique way to look at how Yoda perceived the Force and how to deal with the Force as a Jedi after Order 66.
Yeah.
So that's one for sure. The other one that I would bring up, again, is a darker one, and that would be the Rise of the Old Masters. Because that one, one of the earliest ones, becomes one of my favorite ones simply because it shows Kanan is unsure of himself. It's one of the first times where you really realize that he just doesn't have a clue about what he's trying to do and how he's desperately looking for someone else to help. And then we learn, of course, the ultimate fate of most of the Jedi at that point, possibly all of the Jedi at that point, save for Kanan, in what happened to Luminara and the horror that came of that. I think that episode really was the first one that made me say, okay, this is not going to be the Disney-friendly, Disney afternoon style. This is going to go right back to the Clone Wars, where we're going to have points that are going to be dark and are going to be gritty and are going to be interesting and not just be light, fluffy, and friendly.
Right.
And it had definitely achieved that later on, but I think this is the first episode that, not to say gave it gravitas, because I think that word is overused, but definitely gave it a depth that hadn't yet been there at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the two I would comment on.
Well,
if I was to mitigate between two.
And if I could add something to what you just said, I find it intriguing you chose those two episodes, and I think those two episodes link each other very well, because you talk about the fact that the one with Luminara in it, that both Ezra and Kanan, particularly Kanan, is doubting himself, how very intriguing that you get to Path of the Jedi, and that Path of the Jedi, notice it's Path of the Jedi, and could it be plural? It was an opportunity not just for Yoda to teach and guide Ezra and for Ezra to obtain a crystal, but you see that it's an opportunity for both Padawan and Master to grow together. And Kanan overcomes his doubt, his own personal doubts and fears with a little bit of help from Yoda. So you see the complete turnaround from that first episode that you liked to Path of the Jedi, where the two of them are now ultimately linked for good, for permanent. It was kind of intriguing how they brought that full circle.
For me, that also now kind of makes sense when I look at in the new Kanan comic, which has just come out this month. One of the things it shows is just how young he was when Order 66 came down. So it makes me realize just how little he had experience as anything other than just a basic Padawan.
Right.
So his knowledge was really small by comparison to what maybe we might have thought he had. And it might explain a lot of his concerns. And I think it's really just all of this depth that's come out of ever since actually going back to the book, the A New Dawn. I've really appreciated the additional information because it's really given the series something to build from. And as the series has gone along, it also is built upon it. So everything is just adding to it. And I'm enjoying the fact that this is multifaceted, multimedia, interesting.
Agreed.
So number two then, other than the Ahsoka reveal, which I think, at least for me, was one of the big, big, big moments. What was your biggest moment of the season so far? Or so far of the season? Season one.
You know, it might involve one or both of those episodes, but I probably for me, you know, it's hard to pick a moment in this season, but if I had to pick one, it's back to, it involves two moments. It's one where Ezra realizes, in Path of the Jedi, that it's okay for him to overcome his fears. You know, he learns that it's okay for him to be frustrated as long as he reins it back in. Gains control of it, learns to be patient, learns that path to the Jedi, but then take that back to the very last episode of Fire Across the Galaxy, where he is now in control. he's literally in control of his fear, of himself. He's out to lead the band of rebels to save Kanan, and then Kanan now has to overcome his final fear and does, and you see the two of those might be my biggest reveals and moments is watching the development of Kanan and Ezra throughout the entire series just bloom. That's my biggest moment, is watching the two of them.
Yeah. Certainly that would fit into a category for me as well. I think for me, though, I think the moment I kind of think it's sort of like that point where everything changes. Like, if you watch Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., when before Captain America Winter Soldier, the movie came out, things were going one way, and as soon as that movie came out, it totally flipped the entire series on its head and then rushed headlong into the final. And for a lot of people, including myself, the last half after that movie came out was the better part of the whole series. Whereas the other part of it was kind of like, okay, we're doing the same thing over and over again. Now, not in the same vein, but in the same sort of way, when Tarkin comes into the series, I think it's flipped a lot of things on their head that we had been assuming were going on. And he comes in, he immediately takes charge, he immediately shows how much of an authority figure he is, and is immediately able to turn the Imperials into a bunch of, from a bunch of basically your typical villain with a twirling mustache pathetic, to being a very serious and very imminent threat for all of the rebels that were involved. And in so doing, changes the series from being sort of the usual, oh, those tricky kids got away from us again, to being, okay, these people could die. And we don't know, because we don't know the ultimate fate of this crew. So it suddenly made their peril very apparent, and of course led to Kanan's capture, torture, and all the other things. That moment for me, when he comes off that shuttle at the very beginning of that episode, it signaled the beginning of a lot of change in that series, and took the rebels from being just this little motley crew, if we can call them that, into being a much bigger part of an outside world, and to the point where at the end of Fires Across the Galaxy, they have an entire rebel fleet. Well, fleet might be stretching it, but, you know, there's a crew of ships instead of just being one. They're, you know, a part of a cell of a group.
Right.
And I think for me, that was my big moment. I mean, there was other ones for sure. I think having James Earl Jones come back and do Darth Vader's voice and then what he actually says were huge. I think the other interesting thing was something we didn't learn until after it had already happened, and that was the fact that Dave Filoni had actually interspersed with all of the comments made by Gal Travis. Every time he speaks, the Empire had a thing just before it that he cuts into.
Mm-hmm.
But every time he's cutting into a point on the show where it says, "Don't trust Gal Travis." But I didn't pick up on that until Filoni said they'd done that, and then I went back and listened to him. And went, oh my gosh, yeah, there it is, totally.
Interesting.
But yeah, but you didn't realize it at the time because you're like, oh, you know. But yeah, that was a really interesting little Easter egg that they'd put in, and I'm sure other people have gone, well, I knew that was there the whole time. but I'm not that clued in, so for me that was a real surprising thing to find out.
I wasn't either. You just gave me something new to chew on a bit. So.
Yeah, yeah. Watch the last one he's in. It's really obvious.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really obvious because I watched it again and went, oh, right. Because they say something effective, and in the Empire, we are our most trusted, and it cuts in Gal Travis or something along that line. And you're like, okay, there we go.
All right.
So, yeah.
We're going back to watch it.
Which of the Ghost crew do you think needs more development in season two?
I think almost everybody will agree that it's probably Sabine, and I would have to agree with that as well. However, I would like to know a little more about Zeb as well. It would seem that Zeb, his background, all we know of it is that his home planet was attacked and ultimately destroyed by Agent Kallus with, you know, using those disruptors. I would like to know a little bit more about it. Maybe a recall back to that a little bit. But yeah, Sabine, we need to know about Sabine. She obviously has some links to the Empire, where she was, you know, at the Academy. It didn't turn out so well for her. I want to know more. She's an explosive expert. I want to know where she learned all of that and what made her what she is. She's an artist. It doesn't all just start because of an Academy. There's something that goes beyond that for her, and she's got some serious depth to her, and I'd like to see that.
Yeah, for me, I think with her as well, the fact that she's wearing Mandalorian armor, is she a Mandalorian? Isn't she a Mandalorian? Does she wear it because she hero worships somebody who wears Mandalorian armor? Not going to say the name because we all know who I'm referring to. Because she already has pictures of Cad Bane up there. Does she also follow Boba?
Right.
So what exactly is the reason why she's doing what she's doing, and how does she end up especially in Fires, is it Fires Across? No, it's the one before that, Rebels Resolve, I think, where she does all that leaping. No, it was Fires Across the Galaxy where she ends up doing all the leaping around like Spider-Man.
Yes.
Which had a bunch of people going, wait a second, she's not a Jedi, how is she doing that?
Right.
So this is the kind of stuff that we need to resolve. I agree with you with both choices. I think Zeb, much like Sabine, they gave him information, and it was intriguing information, and then left it.
Yeah.
And I know they've said they're going to go back and fill in gaps, because we know a little bit about Hera, and we have the advantage of a book to read that has even more. But we really don't know that much about those characters. So it would be nice to kind of get an idea of where their background is and what drove them to this point. And I think until we get to that, they'll be underserved and they're not as fully dimensional as they could be.
Agreed.
So final question, and this is sort of a speculative one because we obviously don't know the answer to any of this, but what do you think would be the big surprise or big event that'll be coming in season two?
What do I think will be, or what do I want it to be?
It can be either one as far as I'm concerned, because honestly, it's kind of going to be both, to be fair.
Because it's a fully loaded question for me, because, you know, there's a lot of talk. Now we have Ahsoka in the picture. How much mm-hmm. of Ahsoka are we going to see? Ahsoka and Vader would have to meet up at some point in time. I'm fearful of that meeting for a few reasons, because I like Ahsoka, but we've watched Vader develop. And when we watched him in A New Hope and then in Empire, develop into a ruthless, bloodthirsty killer. I mean, literally, you didn't want to mess with Vader. What concerns me about this is it wasn't until the end of Empire that you started seeing, you know, he now knew about Luke and you know, things started entering into his heart and he started to change. I don't want that to be a focus with Ahsoka either. He had a relationship with Ahsoka. My concern is how do you either make him a completely robotic figure who just doesn't care and kills Ahsoka without a second thought, or do you cause doubt to enter into his thought process that makes him start to question things because now he sees Ahsoka? I don't want that. That's not the Vader we knew in the original trilogy. So that's one thing I look forward to, is what they do with Ahsoka and Vader. Beyond that, I don't know what the big reveal would be beyond that. I mean, I hope that Luke and Leia might have a couple of cameos, but I'm afraid to bring them into it as much either, because it's not time yet. We're still in the early stages of a rebellion being started. So really the main thing I look for in the second season is a lot of backstories. I want to know about these characters that we're involved with. I want to know the stories behind the crew. And whoever that may be, even Agent Callus, I want to know behind some of these characters, and I'm hoping that they get into some mini series during season two that does that.
Yeah, I heard a couple things from Dave Filoni, which makes me suspicious of the whole Vader Ahsoka thing, because, well, for one, he was very specific in saying that he didn't think there had to be a confrontation. And I don't know how you get away with it.
True.
But the fact that he says that makes me wonder, because his point was, as I overheard, it was the fact that everybody was convinced Ahsoka had to die at the end of Clone Wars.
Right.
And he had said, I had a lot of ideas of what to do with her, some of which she died in, some of which she didn't. But I don't have to make a series where she dies. So there's nothing written in stone that she has to die. And he was referring also to the crew. Because, of course, we all think the ghost crew is going to die.
Right.
Because of, you know, Last of the Jedi you will be, blah, blah, blah. And what Filoni is trying to tell us is, don't be surprised if we never get that resolved.
Good point.
So that's the one thing. So that's the first part. I think the second thing is, and this was the Jimmy, I'll be honest and give props to the person who came up with it. Jimmy Mack on Rebel Force Radio suggested the concept that one of the reasons why Vader has his first real twinge with Luke is because he did kill Ahsoka. And the reason why Filoni says he would kill Ahsoka without even thinking about it is because he would look at her as betraying him. You know, everybody right. else betrayed him. She was the first one to betray him because she left him
yeah.
and did nothing. So that would be the reasoning. Hmm. So his point was, is there's no... he would have no compunction because he would look at her the same way he did the rest of the Jedi, and maybe even worse in some respects. Whereas with Luke, it's a whole different kettle of fish because he had none of that backstory attached to him. And so there isn't that same sense of justification.
So I gather from it, Dave Filoni doesn't even know which way he's going to go yet.
No, I don't think so. I don't think they have a clue. In some ways, though, I've consistently asked this actually of a couple of other people, a couple of other podcasters, and they kind of gave me, well, I think it'll be this. The one thing I've wondered about is how long is this series going to go?
Right.
Because I wonder if they will take only a couple of years to do this series. Mostly because my suspicion for this is there may be a thought to get enough to be able to do syndication, but not much more than that, because they'd want to move on to the new movies they're actually issuing rather than the old stuff that isn't owned by them, because the original trilogy is actually owned by Fox at the moment still.
That's a good point.
So I kind of wonder if that's one of the results of that will be that we will see them move away quicker than we thought they would. But
maybe it's a filler.
Other people suggest 5 years, 7 years. I think we'd be grateful if it was 3, just based on that information. And I could be completely wrong, and certainly have been many times in the past. So,
well, and you're not out of the realm of possibilities. And that's, I mean, I've actually thought that very self same thing. So I'm not going to dispute or even throw that one to the side yet, because that's a very plausible idea.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, as far as what I think might be the next thing or event that might surprise us, I would not be surprised if one of the things that we do get, I believe we will get Princess Leia in the next season, but she's going to be 15, 16 years old.
Right.
So we will meet her, but not the person that we meet in the first, you know, original trilogy movie, but rather it'll be the younger lady who maybe doesn't know everything her dad's up to. But I don't know yet. I don't know whether that'll be true or not, because, I mean, she was 18 in A New Hope, so, or 19. So was she old enough at that stage even to have taken on a lot of that responsibility? They kind of lean towards that in the Princess Leia comic books, so I do wonder. Because he's already been, they had a flashback in Princess Leia number 2, which goes back to a discussion that her and Bail had about leadership. And it was very interesting commentary on his ideas of how leadership works.
Sarah Michelle Gellar, maybe?
Yeah, well, and that's the one thing everybody's kind of suspicious about.
Right.
I don't know. It'd be very, the other thing I have suspicions about is I think we are going to see the Emperor in it. I think Sam Witwer will be the voice of the Emperor, because he did the voice of the Emperor for Force Unleashed. And he did a very credible job of it. And I've heard him do it since then, and he still sounds a lot like Ian McDermott.
Hmm.
So I could totally see him doing that voice.
And I would be okay if the Emperor made some appearances in the second season, because next to Darth Vader, the Emperor is right up there in one of my favorite characters from the entire saga. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that'll be it, and I don't think we'll see Darth Vader that much in season 2. I think we'll see him for maybe the first couple episodes, and then he'll be gone till the end of the last episode.
Yep.
I can't see him as the big heavy. I think that's going against everything they said and the whole reason why they had the Inquisitor in the first place. But I think he could be the threat for a little bit early on.
What's more is I don't see him jumping into a position of power at this point in time either, because, you know, when we jumped into A New Hope, he was, and you and I have talked about this on previous episodes, he and Tarkin were almost equals, and I don't know that you want to play into Vader taking control of anything at this point in time, because it is still Tarkin's world and Tarkin's realm to own right now, and Vader is an equal with him, and that's all he is.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm kind of curious to see if they'll pull even Tarkin back during this season. Because they'll have, you know, more like 22, 23 episodes to work with. So they won't need him in every single one.
They could bring in the new Imperial officers, really. I mean, you could find ones that aren't bumbling fools like the last two that they killed. I mean, I'm hoping that they go beyond Lothal. I'd like to see other planets and other systems, and I'd like to see more battles in space, too, that would indicate that the Star Destroyers and the captains and generals who are running them are involved more, too.
Yes, yeah, and I think we will, just from the things I've heard so far, but I guess we'll find out. Now, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Before we end, are you going to be able to go to Celebration?
I am not.
No, okay. You're not the only one.
Yes. I wish. I was hoping. But no.
I was hoping so you could give me a report about the actual season premiere, which happens to be released there.
Yeah, there's a lot of things I'd like to go for because I suspect the season premiere, and also I'm anticipating that they're going to release the first official trailer of Episode 7 at Star Wars Celebration. That's my prediction here, and I'd like to see that too. But
yeah, I would too. I've also heard that it might be released with Avengers, but that's been rumored for a while.
I've heard that as well, and I would see actually both as a possibility. I would imagine that if they do release anything at Celebration, we will most likely see it hit YouTube as an official Star Wars YouTube before it hits theaters as well. But it's hard to say. We'll see.
Yeah, the one thing I will say is I think we'll be back here doing this show sooner than we think because I am very dubious of the idea that they're going to release the season 2 premiere in April and then make us wait till September because that would be crazy.
I actually don't anticipate that either. I thought about that, and I really think if they're going to release the season 2 premiere, I anticipate they may start right into season 2 as of May, but that's just me. I don't know.
I agree with you. I've also heard that they'll do some spring episodes and then take a break and then come back in the fall and do the rest of them.
Which is totally feasible. Totally feasible.
Yep. Yeah. Because so. I think they need to do that because I think they need, well, they don't need to do anything, but I'm suspicious that they're going to try and want to get all the episodes out before we get to A Force Awakens.
Yeah.
That's my thinking about that, but I don't know if that's true, but obviously. But it's a suspicion I have is that they'll want to get it done before before the end of December so that it ties up nicely with The Force Awakens.
That's true.
Which goes back to my feeling that this may not be a series that's very long because that would tie up really nicely with that theory.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We'll see. Anyway, I think we'll wrap up there. And regardless of how long we're away, we will definitely be back to talk about all this again whenever they come out with more stuff.
Indeed, we will. Or whenever our dear friend Rob at Who Wars decides he wants us to talk about something else.
Well, that's it. Exactly. All right. Well, from Alan and myself, thanks a lot, guys.
Still protecting your precious crew. Quite admirable. Now, what I want to know is about the other rebels. Codename Fulcrum. I know nothing of a larger rebellion, and if I did, I'd rather give my life than tell you. So heroic. Just like your master. Tell me, Jedi, how did you survive Order 66?
Hello. So I'm to review Kanan, the last Padawan for Who Wars, and let me tell you, I looked at this book this week, and I've been anticipating it for a number of weeks, not the least of which because I review Star Wars Rebels, but also because I read The New Dawn, and I really like the character of Kanan as it was written in The New Dawn, and I've liked the character since it's come onto our TV screens, and certainly I think Freddie Prinze Jr. does a masterful job playing the character, but the one thing that's always left up in the air is where he came from. We know from A New Dawn that his name is actually Caleb Doom, and that he had a Jedi Master whose name that they've mentioned in both Rebels and I believe in New Dawn is Deepa Bilaba, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, who kind of takes him under her wing. Now, she was on the Jedi Council before the war started, and in the comic book it starts out basically with them actually back with the Rebels crew on the Ghost, and from there it kind of takes off as him remembering this place that they're actually traveling to, which then sets them up as Kanan, now Caleb, is a young Padawan learner who has gone out on his first big mission, and his master is sort of trying to teach him things like patience and how to sort of negotiate and deal with other people. His role in this particular mission is as an assistant, and it's very much clear that he's very inexperienced. And it's interesting to see sort of the interplay between him, his master, and to some extent the two clone troopers that they have with them, Which, of course, leads me to my first point in the fact that if you're expecting this comic to get you past Order 66, you'd be dead wrong, because it actually ends at the command for Order 66. So, spoilers, but that would be one very annoying ending. At least for me, I found it to be just such a evil cliffhanger. I wish the comic actually was a little bit longer. Or maybe that it was just a little bit shorter on action and a little bit more on getting things done. It has sort of a subplot dealing with the locals on the planet that they've defeat the Separatists on, and how those people perceive the Republic as not being any better, and that effectively they're not an improvement. And I assume that they'll go more into this as we split up with the Caleb trying to find his way to being Kanan. The book is well drawn, and I think it does a very good job of giving you expression and giving you a sense of the characters. I mean, on the very first panel after the start, you have the ghost crew, and you can see Ezra's position is very kind of teenage, sort of, why am I here kind of pose, which I think does a really good job of setting him up and his personality type. I think the art done by Pepe Larraz and the colors that were done by Dave Curiel are very consistent with the other Star Wars comic books. They're very vivid, they quite sharply, and they kind of give you a good sense of image and of placement. I think they've done a good job kind of showing the horrors of war as well, which is interesting. And of course, this is written by Greg Weisman, who is a big key in the world here and has been involved with Rebels. I think he offers an interesting perspective, and I think his comic book writing has proven to be quite interesting already. Even the transition going from Kanan to Caleb is entertaining, because the posing is absolutely the same, and yet you can obviously see they're younger people. So, as I say, it's a very nice, well-done comic. I think it does a good job of sort of setting things up. If I have one beef, it says it almost feels a little too short, because there's a lot of, like I say, there's a lot of artistry and not as much plot development, which only happens sort of towards the end. And there almost seems to be a side plot, which I assume will factor into the overall series, but at the moment doesn't really factor in at all. And you're kind of left wondering, why is this happening? There's an interesting moment with Master and a Padawan where they're discussing kind of his development, and I think that does a really nice job kind of showing his need to sort of understand better his role. And interestingly enough, it becomes the spot, it looks like, where he gets the holocron that we find in Spark of Rebellion. Well, that's it from me. We'll have Kanan number 2 next month to discuss, and I look forward to being able to get past Order 66 and actually get to the meat of what goes on after Order 66, because that's probably the least explored in the new canon.
Relax a while in the center's pleasant marina, or visit a theater or brew house.
Well, here we are at the end of the 28th Who Wars. Can you believe that? This has been the first episode where we've spoken to a writer from the original series of Doctor Who, the classic era. It's the first time we've had a Canadian convention report with the AM audio media guys talking to us from Comic-Con. Gosh, what a great episode this has been. If you've enjoyed it, why not pod it on? Why not tell a friend about us? The best way we can get out there among other people is word of mouth. And of course, iTunes reviews as well. If you're an iTunes user, that would be really, really, really good. My thanks to the whole team this episode of Alan and John and M.A. Tamburo, Andrew Chalmers, and of course, Andy, for bringing us such awesome, awesome material. It's just great. And now, following on from the segment I started last week, which is to do more of an editorial in the back page section here, I want to talk to you about bands. That might sound a bit weird, so let me get into this. When I was a kid growing up, it felt like everyone was in a band. It's an exaggeration, sure, but it's what it felt like. Indeed, one day when I was about 16 or 17 and inspired by a diagram I'd seen in a UK music magazine, which was indicating how all the bands from a particular area, it might have been Oxford or something, were all related to each other, I made my own based on bands from my school and in the local area. you know, the lead singer of this band drummed with that band. The bassist from this band was the brother to the keyboardist in another band. The guitarist in that band used to be the guitarist in this band, you know, and so on and so forth. I saw that homemade diagram a year or two back, and I was struck by how complex our local area's musicians were. You know, we ranged from ragtag groups that just practiced together to groups that were more interested in songwriting and recording without actually gigging anywhere. I think I fell into that category more often than not. Through to groups that not only played real gigs, but in at least one case got a real record deal in the process. That was quite exciting. Anyway, you might be legitimately wondering what this has all got to do with the Star Wars and Doctor Who podcast, but the answer is simple. I'm seeing the same thing again in podcast land. I mean, think about it. Bands and podcasts produce the same thing, which is audio content. It's just in a different style. Some of us are solo artists, some of us are duos, some of us are three pieces or even four or five pieces. Some of us started solo before getting involved with a group of people. Some of us started in groups and then went solo. We have followers who can be quite passionate about just what we're doing or what many groups within the genre are doing. Someone might just like Who Wars, or they might like Who Wars and Diddly Dum and 42 to Doomsday and the Blue Box podcast and so on. We fall into levels of popularity. You have everything in podcast land from the equivalent of megastars right down to indie artists. We have veterans who have been slogging away for years. We have newbies who just started last week. Some of us are lo-fi, some of us are hi-fi. Different recording methods complement different styles of content. You know, you think of some podcasts out there, they're almost like FM radio shows. Others feel like two people speaking over a table, you know, with a single microphone between them. And, you know, that hi-fi or lo-fi vibe, I think, suits what's being produced. We guest on each other's albums, or podcasts, as you might want to call them, all the time. Just like Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters will pop up drumming on tracks on other bands' stuff, so too do people crisscross between podcasts. And in a similar way, bands, or should I say podcasts, buddy up and tend to move in the same circles, whether physically or online or sometimes both. You hear about people going to conventions and meeting up from different podcasts, and sometimes the relationships are just online. It's very, very interesting. And I guess when you look at Who Wars as just one example, you can see some of this in play. Sticking with the musical analogy, I started as a solo artist before building up my band, so to speak. We've become friends with other bands doing similar stuff to us, other podcasts. And we've also watched as other bands we really like have changed personnel and become something new, just as bands do in real life. We've taken on extra musicians or extra members of the team, some of whom are still playing with their old bands, some still have side projects of their own. It really does feel like I'm 17 again. But where's this all heading? Where is this bizarre ramble heading? Well, for the keen-eared among you, for the people who have stuck by this podcast, by this episode, right here until the end of it, let me say this. Doctor Who returns to our screens later in 2015, and when it does, you might just see an interesting new supergroup emerge for a dozen gigs or so. It's going to be standing room only, and don't say we didn't warn you. That's all I can say for now, folks. That's all I can say. Well, I can say one other thing. Thank you for listening to Who Wars. We'll see you next week. If you want to get in touch with the show, all the ways to do it are about to be played in the closing credits. Take care of yourselves. We'll see you again in a fortnight's time.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.